Good evening.
Good evening, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
Brilliant. Andrew, you are live on Finding Voices Radio with us here, broadcasting from Freedom Centre headquarters out of the Netherlands. So welcome from everybody who's listening in, and thank you for being with us this evening.
Oh, thanks very much for inviting me. It's good to be on with you.
Great. Andrew, first, I think so everyone can kind of get a context of how you fit into things. Why don't you give us a little bit of a background on yourself and how you came to be on this journey communicating this information?
Well, basically, I've told this story many times, in that my journey, I suppose, sort of started around about 2003, because I came across this thing called the Disclosure Project, which is basically organised by a chap called Dr. Stephen Greer, who was looking into the UFO cover-up and getting some people together to try and sort of testify about that. And in 2001, he organised this big event in Washington DC, and it involved sort of 21 highly qualified witnesses, big press conference at the National Press Conference Club in Washington DC. And I didn't come across any news about this until 2003, when I did start to get a broadband internet connection, so it became more realistic to download things. And following that, I realized that the UFO cover-up was real. There really was something very important being covered up. And one of the connections that Stephen Greer made was the connection between the UFO cover-up and the energy cover-up. In other words, the technology that is used to create energy using little or no fuel. And he was saying that fossil fuels, we've never needed them for sort of at least 50 years. And I've found that is true. And at that time, I never realised that there would be a connection to 9/11, which we can probably get into a bit later. But that was it was really my interest in the UFO issue which kind of started me off on the to the point where I am now. Although, having said that, I've been interested in what might be called alternative knowledge. Since I was quite young, since I was about 10 years old, when I had a UFO sighting way off in the distance, but it was quite interesting nevertheless. So that was really the start of it, was the UFO thing.
Okay, all right. So you now run a website where you've exposed a lot of the 9/11 information that's come out supposedly debunking conspiracy, and you've actually found a lot of that information is in itself a conspiracy. I think that's a good place to start from. Tell us a bit about your work along those lines.
Yeah, well, that's seemingly how it seems to be working, and I call it a cover-up within a cover-up, and I sort of say to people now, well, what I'm going to tell you and show you, even a conspiracy theorist wouldn't believe it, to use that horrible expression, but that's what it ends up being like. But basically, I got involved with the 9/11 truth movement in sort of, I suppose, sort of, let's see. Started to be sort of early 2005, late 2004. They started a UK forum in 2005, and I became involved with that. And that was after a visit by Jimmy Walter, who was a very wealthy philanthropist, who hooked up with William Rodriguez, this guy who claims to be the jet, one of the janitors from the World Trade Center. And he, in later years, William Rodriguez actually stayed at my house. And that was quite an interesting, a few things transpired from that, because I organized a couple of talks for him to speak at. So he ended up staying here with a couple of other folks. But basically I got involved with the UK group, and I assume these are all sort of had the same goals as I did, and that really were twofold. One was to find out what actually happened on 9/11, and the other was to obviously try and disseminate that information in a kind of sort of honest and I wouldn't use the word professional way, because that's not quite the right word, but in a way which people could digest. Over time, I began to realize that things weren't as they seemed, and there were certain topics in 9/11 research which you weren't meant to discuss. And primarily, those two topics I can sort of put into two phrases. One is called no planes, and this is the idea that there weren't any large planes involved in any of the four crashes, and that became a taboo area to talk about, really, particularly on the UK forum, where I was spending quite a lot of my time at that in 2005 and 2006. And then the other one was this idea that some type of energy weapon was used to destroy the World Trade Center. That sort of fairly quickly became an area which was discouraged from being talked about, you know, and they tried to form like a committee in this UK group and a steering committee and all this sort of these silly phrases, and then Ian Crane appointed himself as the chairman of the UK 9/11 truth campaign, which a title which he now no longer uses. And I don't know where that title came from, but somebody apparently thought it was a good idea to use it for a period of time. I followed all these developments, and I wrote various press releases, and it was really, really in 2006 when I'd been invited to join this website called Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and this seemed like a good idea because this Scholars for 9/11 Truth group claimed to be a group of academics mainly based in the US, but not exclusively. There were quite a few non-US people as well. I think there were a couple of folks in Australia, a few folks in the UK like myself, a couple of others dotted around the place, one or two in Canada. And they basically, that group was formed by two characters, one called Jim Fetzer, Professor Jim Fetzer, who was at the University of Minnesota. He retired, I think in 2006 or 2007. And then the other professor, Stephen E. Jones from Brigham Young University, he also helped form that group. And they what had happened was I being looking at how the towers were destroyed, and the thing that really struck me, having a bit of a background in physics, because part of my degree was in physics, I did a degree in computer science with a module of physics, and I looked at the freefall time, and I knew that this was very telling, that something very different to what the official story told us had happened. Because I think Eric Hushman put it very well at the time. He said it was impossible for a building to fall through itself as quickly as it falls through the air. And if you look at the time of destruction of the towers, and I'm not going to say collapse, and maybe we'll get to that later, you come out with this free fall figure as if there was no building there almost.
About 8 to 10 seconds.
Yeah, one was about, the official times vary slightly depending on which sources you read, but one was about 8 seconds, 8.1 seconds. The other was about 10, I think. But if you actually do, if you were to do the calculation for an object falling in a vacuum from 1,368 feet to ground level, there's a very simple calculation you can do, which I knew how to do, because I'd remembered it from my physics classes. And the figure that you come out with is 9.16 seconds, which assumes a vacuum. And in air, it's, maybe like 9.2 seconds or something like that, if you take air resistance into account. So one of the buildings actually disappeared faster than the free fall time. So this was a very clear anomaly, and I was able to write this down with some maths, which, kind of gave it more oomph, I suppose. And I posted this on a forum. I posted this on a physics forum, and it wasn't a 9/11 truth site or anything like that. It was just a regular forum for people to talk about physics and technology and things like that, and interesting topics like that. And I thought, well, I'll go and see if my calculation's wrong, because hopefully there's some people that know about physics on this site. So if I've made an error in this simple calculation, which I was pretty sure I hadn't, then hopefully somebody would pick me up on it and correct it. And anyway, this thread that I posted attracted quite a lot of attention over a period of about 2 years. I think it's still there, this thread. I've got it linked on my website in some articles. And anyway, I think it was a result of that that somebody was obviously out, you know, looking around the internet for anybody that was sort of making sense on this issue and not just ranting and raving. You know, I just literally posted the calculation. I didn't talk about the New World Order or, you know, any of these things because I wasn't really sure of any of that sort of information particularly. And anyway, so I was invited to join this Scholars for 9/11 Truth group by Steve Nee Jones and Jim Fetzer, both of whom were claimed to be university professors. And I thought, oh, great, you know, this is really good because this means we're going to be able to make some arguments with some academic clout behind them, you know. And anyway, the first thing that really happened was that Stephen E. Jones, he came out with this paper that he called it. He called it Why Did the World Trade Center Towers Collapse? That was the title of this paper. I think it was about 25 pages long. And he got us onto this forum. It was actually not a dedicated forum. It was actually an archaeology forum that he set up a corner of for all these scholars. And there were probably about 20 or 30 people who were posting something like that. We all sort of discussed this paper that he'd written. And the central thesis that was in this paper that he'd written was that thermite was used to cut through the steel girders. And that's once these girders had been cut through, then the building came down, and that's what caused it to fall down in the manner that it did. And he cites various sort of anomalous pictures, and I don't think he actually mentioned the free fall timer. And somebody picked him up on that he didn't mention this free fall figure in the paper. And I thought that was a bit peculiar, but again, because I trusted the guy. I thought, you know, he's a Brigham Young University physicist. I think he had tenure, but I'm not sure. But anyway, he was on the staff. You know, he was teaching staff as well. So I thought, this guy seems okay, and he knows what he's talking about. So we'll just run with it. And I actually printed out loads of copies of this paper, and I gave them out in a booklet. I made them into booklets on my, you know, little printer I've got, and I gave out probably hundreds of copies of this to various people, and. You know, nobody in the truth movement questioned this at the time. None of these other people that I was sort of associating with in the UK group or anything really questioned this. So throughout 2006, it was really sort of set up that thermite was used plus other explosives. But no one ever specified what these other explosives were. And then in August 2006, two people I'd sort of got, one person I'd got a vague familiarity with, Dr. Morgan Reynolds, who was at Texas A&M University, and Dr. Judy Wood, who at the time was at Clemson University, they also posted a sort of paper that they'd written, and it was called The Trouble with Stephen E. Jones, and then they sort of retitled it, Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Towers Disintegrate? And they basically took apart this idea that thermite was used to destroy the towers, and in their deconstruction of this Jones paper, my name was mentioned, and it was mentioned in relation to some video editing work that I'd actually done at Stephen E. Jones's request, whereby I'd edited together at Jones's request two clips of supposed molten metal coming out of the towers just before the demise of the, I think it was Tower 1, just before the demise of Tower 1. And it was claimed by Jones that there was this orangey molten metal flowing out of the towers, and that proved that the thermite reaction was going on at that time, and that proved his theory. But when I looked at this paper by Wood and Reynolds, it raised some very, very detailed questions and very powerful questions, and I began to realize that the thermite answer didn't really didn't explain all the evidence. However, I didn't really quite realize what was going on. I still thought that it was just, I was still in this idea, and a lot, you'll hear this now from people, I was still in this idea that, oh well, it didn't really matter whether it was thermite, it didn't really matter whether it was some type of energy weapon or bombs or something else. All we had to do was convince the public that the official story was false because the official story and the mainstream media were our enemy, you know, as it were, and we had to work against them, and so all this infighting about thermite or bombs or whatever was kind of just detracting energy from that. But over the period of the next few months, I began to realise that it was much more important than that, because what Dr. Judy Wood had done was quite clearly she had shown that it was an energy effect that would work, and there was no possible way that this thermite material, which is basically iron oxide, which is rust, and aluminium powder. That's what thermite is. So it's actually a fairly simple material. And they were trying to say all kinds of ridiculous things about it. And these things became even more ridiculous as Dr. Judy Wood presented more and more of her evidence, eventually on her own website, towards the end of 2006. Although she kind of, you know, put it on the internet in 2004, but not really drawn much attention to it at that time. And she was getting attacked, you know, left, right, and centre, really. And she'd also produced another paper, which I initially wasn't aware of, and it was called The Billiard Ball Example. And that very thoroughly addressed this aspect that I'd picked up on with the free fall time. And she'd got this very clear example, you know, and you can just put in, if you want to look for this, put Dr. Judy Wood Billiard Ball Example, and you'll see this simple paper that she wrote. It very clearly illustrates that the way that the towers went away was there was no way it could have been bombs, there was no way it could have been planes and jet fuel. It must have been something else, purely from the way that they disappeared. And that's what the billiard ball example focuses on the manner of the disappearance and the time of the disappearance. And I was thinking, well, why wasn't this paper used? Why was this Jones paper put forward as being the thing to be, you know, everyone to sort of gather round, you know, and wave in the air. But over time, I began to realise that the energy question was very important. And then I think it was around about April, May 2007, the following year, so we're over 5 years ago now, somebody sent me a video. And this was a very, very important video for me, because what it showed was Stephen E. Jones. And he was featured in a year 2000 documentary called Heavy Watergate. And this film, which was, I think, 45 minutes long, it's on YouTube. You can watch the whole thing if you want. Very worthwhile watch. It's about something called cold fusion. Have you ever heard of cold fusion at all? Do you know what that is?
Yes, of course.
Right. So, you know, some people are probably not familiar with cold fusion, but basically, It is a nuclear process which was discovered by Fleischmann and Pons, two electrochemists, and they worked on it for 5 years prior to 1989. And what they discovered was that if you arranged a palladium cathode, and I forget what the anode was made of, possibly zinc, but I'm not sure, and a solution of lithium hydroxide. And also you would put in heavy water, so you deuterate the water, they, under certain circumstances, could get what they called anomalous heat production, or excess heat. And it appeared that during a certain run of their experiment, you know, if they ran the experiment and put in 100 watts of power, they might get 120 or 200 watts of power out as they measured the heat output. And, of course, this was... No. In other words, you couldn't get out more energy than you put into an experiment, because that breaks the second law of thermodynamics. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch and all that sort of, those sorts of sayings. You know, there's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, and all that came to the sort of fore, really. And what it turns out is that Stephen E. Jones was one of the figures who was involved. He didn't say that Pons and Fleischmann were wrong, but what he said was that cold fusion as a process, you know, could never produce energy in any useful way. And he claimed that he knew this because he'd done his own experiments in what he called cold fusion. It was actually Stephen E. Jones who coined the term cold fusion. Other people didn't like it. Other physicists thought it was a very sort of layman's term, which was inappropriate. They preferred to call it low energy nuclear reactions or chemically assisted nuclear reactions. And so Jones was doing what we call a limited hangout. He said, well, Cold Fusion works, but it's never going to be any use because I've done my own experiments and they don't really produce any excess heat. So I think Pons and Fleischmann are wrong. And he basically sort of was one of the people, he wasn't the only one, I have to say that. He was one of the people that basically sort of tried to pour skepticism onto the findings of Pons and Fleischmann, and eventually they were forced to break away from their university and go and do their own research, which was privately funded for a time by Toyota. And the whole, you can read about the whole Cold Fusion affair in a book called Fire from Ice by Dr. Eugene Malov. And he worked for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And Malov is definitely one of the good guys, because what Malov discovered was that Massachusetts Institute of Technology, they falsified their own reproduction, or falsified the results, rather, of their own reproduction of the cold fusion experiment. And they hid the data which showed that there was excess heat. And Malov found this out, and as a result of him finding this out, he realized that they were acting fraudulently. And essentially, he at that point left MIT and he formed a group. I think it was called the New Energy Foundation. And he took the view that we needed to get more research properly funded into things like cold fusion. And he later looked into other energy phenomena, such as those discovered by Wilhelm Reich in the 1950s and 60s. And anyway, so Malov ended up doing that. And he realized that the military-industrial complex, and as he called it, the academic government complex, were preventing certain types of research being done into certain types of energy phenomena. And then he basically carried on that research until he was murdered in 2004. At the time, apparently, he was trying to get together a demonstration for a group in Congress to look at some of the promising technologies which he had helped to get attention focused on. And I think, you know, it's interesting to note that Stephen E. Jones, having been involved in cold fusion for a couple of years in the late 80s, early 90s, then pops onto the scene of 9/11 in 2005. He comes onto the scene and he gets this big splash on the Tucker Carlson show immediately following the publication of 10,000 pages of technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center that were published by a group called NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology. And at the time, I had no inkling of this timing of this, you know, because I didn't know who Judith Jones was. I didn't really realize that the NIST reports came out in 2005. I didn't even read them. I wasn't particularly interested in them, actually, because I knew they would be dishonest, and indeed they were. So already by 2007, I'd seen that there was this link between energy and 9/11 from the research of Dr. Wood and the energy effects that she documented in the evidence, which, you know, we can talk about a bit more. And then I knew that there was something not right with Jones. And I also knew that the amount of attention that was being focused on his paper was also something very strange about that. So I don't know where you want to take it from there. I mean,
that's very interesting. So now you've obviously started suspecting at this stage there's something going on in the 9/11 truth movement. Where did you go to from there? I mean, did you start digging deeper and campaigning to have other information exposed?
Well, essentially, yes. I essentially started to do that at the beginning of 2007, because the thing that really kicked me off was I'd got into touch with Dr. Judy Wood. I'd spoken to her a couple of times on the phone, and we were brought into contact with each other through a chap called Frank Ferguson, who lives quite near the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and we eventually, in 2008, I went over to meet Dr. Wood, and we stayed at Frank Ferguson House, and he organised a couple of interviews for us with a very, very well-known local figure called Ambrose Lane. And in January 2007, a presentation had been organised at the National Press Conference Club, which, you know, it's interesting that it's the same venue as this disclosure project, and I don't think this is any, well, it's not, it's more than just a coincidence, and you know, I can go into that later a little bit possibly if we get time, because there's a whole web here which I think, you know, we can map out at least to some extent.
Sure.
And it connects people like Greer and Fetzer and Jones and a few other people seem to be connected into this. And so in 2007, Jim Fetzer gave a presentation at the National Press Conference Club about 9/11. And he talked about Dr. Judy Wood's energy weapon evidence, although she herself didn't give a presentation.
Yeah.
She basically was asked by Fetzer to travel with him from Clemson to Washington D.C., which, you know, it's quite a distance. It's I think it's about 800 miles, something like that, possibly more. After this presentation that Fetzer gave, Dr. Wood was approached by this character called Dr. Greg Jenkins, and the weird thing is, really, is that nobody would have known or almost nobody. In fact, we know that I think there were three or four people who knew that Dr. Judy Wood would be at this event. Anyway, Greg Jenkins approached her, and he'd brought with him, I think, two cameras and some lighting equipment, and he'd also gone into a separate room away from where this presentation was held. And he asked Dr. Judy Wood to do an interview with him. And this essentially was an ambush interview, and I ended up writing this up because he later videoed this. He video obviously recorded this interview on camera, with two cameras, and then he posted it.
Andrew?
Can you hear me?
Hello? Hold on, everybody. We seem to have lost Andrew. Let me give him a quick ring back.
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Hi, Andrew.
I'll be back again now.
All right, listen, I've just stepped out of the recording studio. We've got a song going, so no worries. Sometimes happens. All right, I'm going to take you back in live, so if you wouldn't mind just keeping the volume down until I reintroduce you back on after the song. Hello?
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, right, I'll put the volume on me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody, and we're back. We got Andrew Johnson back with us. Sorry, we had a little break in the Skype transmission, and we are actually having some gremlins attacking our server, so it seems we might be having gremlins from both sides. We're going to have Andrew Johnson back with us. Andrew, are you there?
I'm here.
Brilliant, thank you. All right, where were we? Where did we get up to?
Well, we got up to this Dr. Greg Jenkins interview at the press conference club, and that's when I saw that this had happened, I realized that this was you know, a sort of professionally done, pre-organized, premeditated thing that, you know, that had been set up. So I thought, right, I've got to start documenting this because I know there's something going on here, and it's obviously something very important because somebody's gone to quite a lot of trouble to attack Dr. Judy Wood. And essentially, since the beginning of 2007, the attacks have never stopped. And there's been kind of like sine waves where they've dropped off a bit and then they've come back in severity. And, you know, you go and Google Dr. Judy Wood's name in relation to 9/11. You read all kinds of trash and nonsense. Most of it generated by people like Jim Fetzer. But anyway, without going into the details of that, which people can read for themselves if they choose to do so, This Jenkins interview where Dr. Wood stood her ground and basically presented Greg Jenkins with some basic issues he had to deal with, the main one being where did the buildings go? And Dr. Judy Wood had illustrated with a few photographs that basically what happened to the towers is they turned to dust. And there's probably two pictures which she showed me early on in our sort of conversations, which made me realize that she had some very simple observations which other people were not addressing. And the particular picture, we came to call it the intermission picture. And what this picture shows is building number 7 from the World Trade Center in the background behind a sort of cloud of fumes. I'm not going to call it a cloud of smoke because it's not necessarily smoke. Building 7 is behind a cloud of fumes. And so we therefore know that this picture was taken before about 5:20 in the evening, because we know that building number 7 was destroyed at 5:20 in the evening or thereabouts. And this particular picture shows World Trade Center 6 in the background, which is 8 stories high. And in the foreground, you see nothing except a few steel girders on the ground, and you see a fireman sort of in the center of this picture sort of walking across some of the steel girders and debris that's there. In other words, the remains of the building, which people try to call a debris pile, isn't even one story high. So you've got a bit of a problem. And for example, just to dwell there before we go back to the Jenkins cover-up thing, people talk about the steel having been shipped to China. Well, with this single picture, you can see that even that story is not true, because the majority of the building was gone by the time it reached the ground. It turned into dust. And Dr. Wood then went on to produce more evidence that this is true, and she's had to do this because so many people can't believe it. So the Jenkins interview essentially tried to challenge these observations that the steel, as you can see, turns to dust. And as she pointed out, I don't think she maybe pointed out in the Jenkins interview, but if she didn't then, she did very soon afterwards. You can actually see pieces of steel. If you watch the videos, you can see pieces of steel coming to the ground, and they're actually turning to dust as they come towards the ground, which is quite an extraordinary phenomenon to observe. But because, you know, people have been told about thermite and Osama bin Laden and jet fuel and pancakes and all this stuff, they don't even see it. That's completely hidden from their view, even though it's actually quite plain when you get rid of all the crap and go and watch it again. It also turns out that this Jenkins character had done work for the NSA, had done research papers funded by the NSA, and he was also involved in some energy type of research. I forget the exact nature of that. So he had some dubious connections, it turns out. And so there was the Jenkins interview, then following the Jenkins interview, Dr. Judy Wood was doing her own ongoing research, and she wasn't really put out by that at all. And she was actually, at the time, working on something called a request for correction. And the request for correction, which will bring us into the next stage of the cover-up, what this request for correction was to do with these technical reports that I'd mentioned earlier in the conversation. In 2005, the National Institute for Standards and Technology had been given a mandate by Congress prior to this, prior to 2005. I think it was in 2003 they were given a mandate. And they were given, I think, a budget of $16 million to explain how the World Trade Center towers were destroyed. Because obviously that's sort of something like that had never happened before. And they employed 23 contractors, some of whom turned out to be contractors for the military industrial complex, which I'll get to that later. They were tasked with producing technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center, such as, for example, how the fire safety equipment performed, what caused the fire to actually make the building collapse, and indeed Underwriters Laboratories. They rebuilt a whole floor or a whole section of a floor with the same materials as the World Trade Center was constructed from. They set it alight with fuel. They burned it for twice as hot, twice as long, and the thing didn't collapse. Yet they signed it off as their report and their simulation as being an accurate explanation for the destruction of the towers. Their report was signed off as being an explanation for the destruction of, you know, that part of the towers, even though their model didn't reproduce what was seen, which was, of course, was fraud. It was they took money, they produced a report, they said it was explained things and it didn't. So they took money and they committed fraud by the definition of the Data Quality Act, which was this act that you can use to sue companies for when they produce a report which is inaccurate or wrong. They have to correct it. Otherwise, you can sue them, which we'll get to, as I say, in a couple more minutes, probably. So these technical reports have been produced. They're actually 10,000 pages long. You can download them all if you want to from this website in PDF form, and we did that. And Dr. Wood was challenging these reports because she didn't explain. They said that, you know, she showed that they didn't explain how the towers turned to dust. And she used a 50-page document which showed how the towers were turning to dust before they hit the ground. She showed the seismic signature, which was in proportion to the buildings, was also almost non-existent. So the buildings didn't make the ground shake when they came down. She also showed that the bathtub, which was a concrete kind of slurry wall within which the towers were constructed, was not damaged by the coming down of the buildings, even though when they went to clear out the mess, they were worried about earth-moving equipment damaging the slurry wall, which would then, of course, Manhattan to flood if it breached the wall. And this was another thing that people like Jenkins couldn't explain. They couldn't explain why the bathtub hadn't been damaged. So she produced this request for correction, which went to NIST, and she says, look, you need to correct your technical reports or get your contractors to do so. Otherwise, I'm going to say that under the Data Quality Act, you've committed fraud, and I'm going to sue you. That's essentially what she did. So, and she did that. She ended up, she submitted the request for correction, I think, in April 2007, with the help of attorney Jerry Leapart, who kind of organized this, and it was his idea to use the Data Quality Act in the first place. And then, 3 weeks after she submitted her request for correction, guess what? Stephen E. Jones and Richard Gage and several other named individuals under the auspices of somebody called James Gourley, who was also an attorney, they also submitted a request for correction to NIST, and it was centered around thermite. But if you go and read this RFC, and I show this in my presentations, which I did one in the south of England on Thursday last week when I showed this document. If you look at their two documents, the request for correction and the appeal to that request for correction, you'll find only three mentions of the word thermite. And in all three cases, this does not refer to Stephen E. Jones's paper, original paper, on 9/11, on his 9/11 research, it refers to something else. So if they're so convinced, and indeed since then, the Architects and Engineers Group, the Architects and Engineers 9/11 Truth, will only talk about bombs in the building, and they will only talk about thermite. They won't talk about anything to do with energy effects, which is what Dr. Wood has catalogued over and over again. They won't talk about the seismic signature, not very much anyway, about the destruction of the buildings. And there's other things which we'll get to which they won't talk about either. And they wouldn't even put thermite into their request for correction. And we think the reason is that they know that this theory is fraudulent. And to put fraudulent information into a court action, or what could become the basis for a court action, is itself, of course, fraudulent. So they could be prosecuted for that. And Dr. Wood had already started this QI-TAM case based on the RFC. And the Architects and Engineers Group, they never started a QI-TAM action. I think they talked about, made various mumblings, but they never did and still haven't. So Dr. Judy Wood and Jerry Leapart and Dr. Morgan Reynolds, and there was another chap called Ed Haas, who's kind of faded out of the picture a bit since then, they were the only three people who submitted legal documents to challenge the official reports, the technical reports, about the destruction of the World Trade Center. And so I got involved with that initiative. I got involved with trying to sort of package up some of the documents to be sent to NIST. And I actually contributed some of the funds, because there was quite a considerable cost associated with doing that, because you need to get these documents reproduced and so on for any judges that look at them. And that case was submitted in 2007, and it was unsealed in September 2007. Judy Wood's case was, Morgan Reynolds' case was unsealed a bit earlier. And I then wrote press releases about this action, and I then posted this press release on the UK 9/11 forum, which I was still making contributions to at the time. And one of the other people running that forum, he then moved my press release from the news section into what they call the controversies section. And that person that moved that posting was a person called Tony Gosling, who was one of the other moderators on there. He did not ask my permission to move the post. And he tried to justify his decision in doing that. And I pointed out to him that these documents were all available for public scrutiny. This had gone to the Court of the Southern District in New York City. It was an official action. And I couldn't really understand why anybody would not be supporting this action, because it was based on evidence which had been collected by a specialist in materials engineering science, which was the area of expertise that Dr. Judy Wood possessed. So she was the only qualified scientist to have legally challenged the technical reports produced by the US government, or an arm of the US government at least, and yet nobody wanted to talk about the evidence. Instead, they wanted to talk about controlled demolition, they wanted to talk about thermite, which had not been submitted in a legal challenge to NIST, or essentially it hadn't anyway, if you go and look at the actual way the document is put together. So it appeared that what was happening, it became quite clear to me then, that we had a small group of people who were dedicated to exposing the real evidence of what happened on 9/11 and trying to draw attention to it. And then we had another group of people who were focused around a fake group called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I must also point out that probably in early part of 2007, the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group split off into two groups called Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, and Jim Fetzer maintained the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group, and Jones had the Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. And also, I mean, I'm giving a sort of very quick overview of this, but I've written a whole book about this. It's called 9/11 Finding the Truth. And you can download this from my website for free. My website is checktheevidence.com. You can download it as a Kindle book, also free. You can download it for your iPad. That's free. It's been loaded onto the iBooks website, so you can get it on there. I think you have to Google my name and 9/11 in iBooks, and it will come up. So all that information is available, which documents my involvement with the Scholars Group, to some extent. It documents the breakup of the scholars group. It documents the what happened with the court case. And it documents the what happened with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which I'll go into a little bit more. But I already could see that we had like we came to call it the official conspiracy theory, in that if you went round, and it still happens now, if you go and look at pilots for 9/11 Truth, you go and look at lawyers for 9/11 Truth, you go and look at Patriots Question 9/11 website, you'll invariably find a link to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, or Scholars for 9/11 Truth, or Alex Jones, or whatever. You will not find links to my website, and you will not find links to Dr. Judy Wood's website. You will not find links to Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go? .com, that website, which is where her book is sold through. So you won't find any of those things on these, all these, almost all of these websites. Most of the websites that link to Dr. Judy Wood or myself are run by, you know, one or two individuals, perhaps like your website, maybe, and you know, there's a couple of guys that I know, in other guys in Europe. You know, the Red Ice folks have linked to my website, and they've interviewed both myself and Dr. Judy Wood. Veritas show. People like this, the smaller independent sort of people who are not really a big movement trying to rally people around, they will link to these websites and give people a chance to review the evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. Andrew, I just wanted to mention at this point that we had Richard Gage coming out here last year to Amsterdam, and I was actually sent an invitation to his event. Mm-hmm. I think it's Richard Gage for Architects and Engineers.
Right.
He came around doing a presentation here, and I thought, okay. And now at this stage, I'd actually seen Dr. Judy Wood's information. I had it presented to me by Richard Hoagland, as we previously discussed.
Oh, yeah.
But I had an understanding of the fact that, yes, and I believe that very definitely could have been a free energy weapon that caused the destruction of the towers. I then got this invitation to Richard Gage, mm-hmm. and I said, yes, no problem, we'll come. Could I interview him? They said, yes, sure, you can get in touch with him directly. And next thing, I posted something I found that Judy Wood had written or something like that, something about something to do with Judy Wood. Mm-hmm. Next thing, they got sent me an email saying, just to let you know, we have absolutely no interest in any of Dr. Judy Wood's theories or stances. And if you're coming to ask us those questions, we're not really interested in giving you an interview.
Right. Well, that falls precisely into line with my experience with them. I mean, I never joined that group because I knew at the time if they were promoting molten metal and thermite, that was fundamentally dishonest. But further to that experience in 2007, let's focus on Architects and Engineers initially, because this is a good one to sort of look at the evidence for and what they're up to. We were contacted by a medical student who was based in Illinois. I think he was in his 20s, and he essentially had a similar experience to what you just described. And what happened was he joined the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 group, and he'd given them $100 for their sort of, you know, operations, sort of petitions and so on. And later he discovered Dr. Judy Wood's Ketam case. And he wrote to Richard Gage and said, oh, have you heard about this Ketam case? You know, have you had any involvement with it? Do you know anything about it? And he didn't hear anything back. A few days later, he discovered that his name had been silently deleted from the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth petition. And there was no explanation for this at all. He couldn't really understand why this had happened. So he ended up writing to us. And he actually sent us the ultimate response that he got, and I'll probably be able to dig this up if you just give me a minute while I'm just filling with this. But basically, they said to him, I'll just try and get this up, and I can actually read out.
Take your time.
Yeah, I'll just get this up in a minute. And they said to him, well, you know, we've chosen to limit our message to a particular thing. They said that we've chosen to limit our message to, I think I can get it here. Okay. I'm nearly there, I think. Oh, yes, here we are. So they deleted him from the petition, Abe. They deleted from the petition. This is all on my website, so you can go and read this if anybody wants to read this. We decided to remove you from our list of petition signers because, whether you knew it or not, we have chosen to carefully limit the scope of our message to the collapse of the World Trade Center. As I said, it didn't collapse, so they're already wrong there with that word. And the need for a new investigation that would specifically consider the use of explosives in bringing it down. Our message is displayed on our website in the petition and mission statement. The evidence supporting our message is found on our website, which I'm sure you have seen since you signed our petition. Your suggestion about contacting Judy Wood and engaging in a discussion with her about her theories about directed energy weapons, and it's not a theory either, it's a set of evidence which leads you to a conclusion, it's not a theory, and other things is a suggestion for action that is outside the scope of our message. We would lose more than we would gain. If nothing else, we would lose the time required to make such a contact and engage in a discussion debate whose duration would be unknown. We are also well aware of Judy Wood and her theories. The reason we don't support her or her theories is that they are outside the scope of our message. No, they don't say that she is incorrect, because they don't have any evidence that she's incorrect. There is a lot of evidence besides the characteristics of controlled demolition seen in the collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7 that strongly suggests or proves that the official story of 9/11 is false. As you know, 9/11 is a very complicated subject, yet architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth deliberately avoids those topics. We leave it to others to make those arguments and present the evidence to the public, to Congress, and so on. If you will tell us the total amount of your donations, we will refund all your money. You mentioned that you donated this money, and then he goes on about that. And this is from Mark Graham. That wasn't from Richard Gage. So in other words, Mark Graham is, you know, just this sort of lackey that's responded on behalf of Richard Gage because he can't actually respond himself.
Because he's obviously a controlled little puppet.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what he is. Now, if you didn't think that was bad enough, then basically what you can listen to is last year, we have a friend in Alaska called Ralph Winterode, and he runs a show on RBN. And he's been very supportive of what we've been trying to do and been very helpful. And what he chose to do is he chose to invite Richard Gage on and interview him. And, you know, that was quite useful because Ralph Winterode, he's not that well known, you know, so he was able to get an interview, I think, without Gage knowing who he was. And within that interview, Ralph is kind of a bit sort of, he's kind of got slightly hot under the collar because you know that Gage is squirming around. And, he answers, he asks Gage, have you looked at the evidence in Judy Wood's book? And Gage claims that Judy Wood is ignoring the evidence for thermite, and she's not. That is also a lie because she deals with why it's not thermite quite extensively, and I've dealt with that quite extensively too. And then he says, if she's going to ignore all of that evidence, she's not practicing science, she's practicing witchcraft. And he actually says that in the interview. You know, which of course is just totally ridiculous to come out with that sort of statement.
Yeah.
You know, he could say, well, you know, we just don't agree, and he could have just left it at that. But to have such an ad hominem, such as that, you know, and I've essentially been cataloguing this list of ad hominems over the years, and how people have essentially, one of the themes that's emerged is, for example, to go back to this Jim Fetzer character, he claims, and he still makes this claim, that he is Judy Wood's biggest supporter. Because from 2006, from November 2006 until approximately June 2008, he had Dr. Judy Wood on his radio program about 20 times, I think, going through all of the evidence that was being she was actually discovering through that period of time. And, you know, if you go onto my website and the audio archive there, you can listen, if you wanted to, you could listen to all these programs and how the story developed. So we started off assuming that Jim Fetzer was actually an honest fellow, you know, and he was trying to find the truth and he was looking at the evidence. But what it turns out is he's essentially a handler. I remember bringing this up in another interview, and I described him as a handler. He was basically handling us and keeping tabs on where we got to with the research and maybe giving us a prod here and there, although he didn't do that particularly a great deal. He was very sort of complimentary towards me because I wrote this article about the witness accounts describing what witnesses saw in relation to the second plane, supposed plane crash at the World Trade Center. He was very complimentary to me about that. But then when I started sort of talking about what we talked about later, which was the Hutchison effect, which I'll talk about a bit in a bit, he became very derogatory and he called me a child and said I was foolish and that, you know, talking about the Hutchison effect wasn't going to get anybody anywhere. And then he actually sort of issued this thinly veiled threat to Judy in an email to Dr. Judy Wood, and he said, if she is prepared to back off her relations with John Hutchison, then there is a chance that her reputation can be salvaged. So, in other words, he was saying that he was going to trash the reputation of Dr. Judy Wood if she continued to talk about the Hutchison effect in relation to 9/11. And that's exactly what we did. We continued to talk about the Hutchison effect because it is very relevant to what happened to the towers. It's because that's what the evidence shows. It's not a theory. And Fetzer made good on his threat to trash the reputation of Dr. Judy Wood, and he's been doing it since that day, and he continues to do it up to this point in time. So, you know, I've written probably over 100 pages of this book is about Fetzer, or mentions Fetzer and what he's been up to. But I think it's important for me to sort of get into this Hutchison effect, because people may not be familiar with this. I don't know if you're familiar with this.
I was just about to ask you, and because I know John Hutchison's work quite well. Actually.
Oh, good. Well, a few people do, because, you know, and Fetzer, this was another point when Fetzer lied, because when I was talking about the Hutchison effect in relation to 9/11 with Dr. Wood, and I was saying to him, well, look, no, we know, you know, we've known about this. And he said, oh, you said you're taking this for granted. And I said, no, I'm not taking this for granted, because I've known about the Hutchison effect since 1999. In other words, that was 9 years before I'd ever, through Dr. Judy Wood, made the connection to 9/11 with it. And and basically, the Hutchison effect is not really a single effect. You probably obviously got some awareness of it, but what John Hutchison is a Canadian independent experimental researcher, and he was trying to reproduce the work of Nikola Tesla in the late 1970s, and he was using radio frequency equipment, RF generators. He was using microwave generators, radar equipment, electrostatic source, Tesla coils, or a Van de Graaff generator to generate high voltage static electricity. And by combining these sources of energy and field effects together, he found that he got some very strange things happening. He got things flying up in the air, in other words, levitation and anti-gravity effect. He found that he was getting effects on the background radiation, which is normally picked up by a Geiger counter. He was getting effects on metal where it was turning to jelly or it was breaking in half. And he was getting weird fires. And then he was getting these effects sort of randomly occurring after he'd switched the equipment off, as if there was some kind of time effect with them. And actually, a lot of people got quite interested in this, because guess what? A guy called Colonel John Alexander, who later became the head of the non-lethal weapons program and has been called Dr. Death by certain people, he became quite interested in John Hutchison's research. And in 1983, when he was representing Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where the atomic bomb was developed, he spent 4 months working with John Hutchison on some of these experiments and trying to more reliably reproduce these effects. And the levitation, the fracturing of metal, and so on. But according to what John told us, it appeared that John Alexander appeared to be familiar with these effects before he'd seen them in John's experiments. So it would be my guess that there was a secret group with which he had some connection that was already doing similar research and already knew what it was capable of. And ultimately they knew it or they were developing it into the capability to turn buildings to powder, which is what happened on 9/11. So basically, we knew that we'd seen the evidence that the Hudson effect was very important in relation to what happened to the towers. And when we first sort of spoke about this publicly to any great extent was in January 2008 on the Ambrose Lane show, which was, I've got the recording of that, and that was on a local radio station in Washington, D.C. area, and that was thanks to Frank Ferguson. And it was at that point, within 16 hours of that broadcast going out, that this character called Ace Baker, whose name also pops up in relation to 9/11 research, particularly in relation to this video fakery issue, he then started attacking us. And he claimed that John Hutchison was a fraud and that all the videos that he'd made were fake. And then Ace Baker went on to make a fake video and claimed that because he could reproduce this levitation effect using a fakery technique, then that's what John Hutchison did. Which is ridiculous because that's like, you know, making a fake video about a car crash and then claiming that all car crashes are fake. You know, it's just ridiculous. And these are the sorts of tactics that we used. And then I've written, you know, whole two or three chapters in my book about that whole charade. So
there seems, Andrew, to be very much a controlled opposition element working through the truth movement. And this is obviously how I came to know of you as someone who follows my work in exposing controlled opposition. And I really have gone on to expose almost every single big name in the truth movement. And it really is, as you said, it's a smaller, independent, unknown people who really are the ones pioneering the actual truth. And whereas the others really seem to be just another layer of the conspiracy.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, if we talk about that for a few minutes, that's right. And I think there are several reasons for that. I think some of them, you know, some of them just have a big ego and they've started to make a living out of this. So, you know, they've kind of got to do it in that way. And that they you know, it's a bit like Ian Crane, for example. He runs this thing as a business now, you know, so he's kind of... Whether he's you know, working for MI5 or not, I don't know. But whether he's doing that or not, there are now certain constraints placed on what he can do because he's having to make a living from doing it. And then there are other people who are clearly, like Jim Fetzer, he is on a mission. He's definitely on a mission. There's no question that he is on a mission. And he does appear to have some very strange abilities, if you ask me. So you get that side of things, and then you get the groups like Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. That group must have some funding from somewhere because you look at all the material that they produce, and they often, you know, don't charge admission for their presentations and so forth. So they must be getting funding from somewhere, and you know, you can go. They're actually now a tax deductible organisation as well. You know, for contributions. So they've obviously got some government seal of approval on them. You know, it's quite funny. If you go and look at their website, you can find it somewhere, I think. So, yeah, so there are so many that are controlled. And then other people don't realize that. And they just get sucked into it. They get sucked into this whole, you know, sort of whirlpool of goings on. And they don't really see... They forget, they lose the focus on the actual evidence, and it then becomes more about, you know, following a person or a figurehead. And that's you know, somebody said to me the other day, oh, you know, you've got more followers than so-and-so. And I wrote back, well, I hope they're not following me. I hope what they're doing is looking at the evidence, because if they're following me, we're in trouble. You know, they should be looking at the evidence themselves and using their own brain, because I might have forgotten something or missed something out. You know, and I actually had a recent example of that demonstrated to me where I had kind of, you know, there was this new 9/11 thing that started and I thought it looked pretty good. But then somebody pointed out to me that it was almost certainly controlled on opposition. Yeah. Again, you know, I was kind of giving him the benefit of the doubt. And this guy wrote to me this 9/11 crash test thing. And that's a new thing that's just started in the last couple of weeks. And I thought, I read what the guy had written to me and I thought, yeah, he's almost certainly right. He'd broken it all down within about blooming half an hour, you know, and I was still sort of working it out. Yeah. So I was glad, you know, that this guy was ahead of me, you know, and pointing this out. And that's what people need to be like, you know. And like what Michael Sarian said in a talk, I think, that he gave a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, don't put people on a pedestal. You know, this is half the problem, because if you put people on a pedestal, all you're going to get is a kick in the face, you know, and he's right. And you've got to get away from this sort of mentality and just go for the raw information as best you can, you know, and pull it apart and use your own brain to work it out, you know. I mean, by all means, ask others what they think of it, you know, and what their experience is. You know, we've shared some information, for example, and it's always very useful to do that. But, you know, you may come to a different conclusion, you know. But that doesn't stop me talking for myself, you know, saying with certainty what I know to be true, you know. I know, for example, the towers turned to dust. And I know that people were levitated. I know that cars turned upside down. And another bits of knowledge is I know that there was a hurricane called Hurricane Erin, which travelled in a straight line for 4 days prior to 9/11. And then on the 9/12, on the 12th of September, made a right-hand turn and moved off out towards Newfoundland. You know, no one will talk about that.
Let's talk about then what actually happened, as conclusively as you can put it across without obviously demonstrating off pictures.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, we have obviously the official story that planes did all the damage and the buildings burned down and then fell down. And then we have the 9/11 Truth Movement's version, which is several variants, several flavours. One is, just bombs in the building. The other is thermite and bombs. The other is mini nukes. The other is underground nukes, the one pushed by Dmitry Karlazov. And I've addressed most of these in my book. And then the other is that there's some type of energy weapon involved. Now, one of the key pieces of evidence, which architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth claim is the only piece of evidence, it's not the only piece of evidence, but it is one of the key pieces of evidence, is what we call one of the easiest things to see, I suppose, when I say key piece of evidence, is what we call the spire. Now, there is a segment on video, and we have several sets of stills of this, where we have a section of the, I think it's Tower 2, 70 stories high of unsupported steel, and in this video clip that you see, which is about 8 seconds of video, you can see this segment turning to dust before your very eyes with no obvious explanation. In other words, there's no bright flashes, there's no nuclear explosions, there's actually no sound even. You can just see this 70 stories of steel going from like a grid structure into dust within about 7 or 8 seconds. So the only way to explain that is some external force or energy acting on those columns to make them disappear, because steel doesn't do that. It does not do that. It just doesn't. So you're looking at a new type of process. So that's one of the first things. One of the second key pieces of evidence is the amount of dust and the way that the towers turn to dust. You can actually see, as I mentioned earlier, some of the steel pieces turning to dust before they hit the ground. Some sort of process is going on. You then have the dust cloud. Now, people like Dmitry Karlazov claim that there was an underground nuclear device 77 meters underground, which set off this nuclear reaction, and then the towers kind of were melted down into this basement area. There's no evidence for that, absolutely no evidence for that at all. There's almost no heat. We have pictures of people walking around in the basements. We have pictures from the mall stores that Dr. Wood focused on early in her research. The mall stores where we had the Warner Brothers store, for example, where they recovered these sort of 5-foot-high figures of Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner and the rooster figure, I forget his name. They were all recovered from the Warner Brothers shop, which was underneath these 110-story buildings. There were no nukes under there. There were no bombs under there. There was no molten metal. People claim to have seen molten metal, and maybe they did. But we would contend that if they did see molten metal, that metal wasn't hot, because the molten metal effect is, guess what, one of the effects seen in John Hutchinson's experiments. And guess what? What the witnesses report? Well, let's take two of the witnesses, shall we? David Sandvik and David Hansher. David Sandvik was an emergency medical technician He reported as the towers were coming down, or one of the towers, sorry, was coming down, he dove under an ambulance and he put his hands over his head or whatever to shelter himself. And then when the tower had come down, the ambulance was gone. Where had it gone? It had been lifted off from above him. We see pictures of cars upside down. I've got several pictures that Dr. Woods given me. I've put them in my articles. Cars upside down, parked next to ones next to the right way up. We have the New York Daily News photographer, David Hansher. He recounts how, in an interview with Charlie Rose from October 2001, he recounts how he was lifted up and he was carrying a block. He didn't use the word levitated, but he was lifted up by this sort of hot gravel, he describes it. I've got another guy who was lifted up and thrown against the wall of the building by a blast of warm air, not hot air, warm air. He specifically says that. We have we have another witness, Rennie Davila, who talks about a force going into his bag. So we've got the levitation to explain. We have other effects, such as what are known as Scott packs. The Scott packs were the oxygen tanks that the firemen used. Now, on the fire trucks, they mounted their Scott packs, obviously, so that they could put them onto their backs and then go into the buildings. We have reports in these 500 witness accounts that I downloaded from the New York Times website. We have reports of these Scott packs exploding on the backs of the fire trucks spontaneously. Why on earth would oxygen tanks explode? Well, I'll tell you why, shall I? Because one of the Hutchison effects is the weakening of metal, the fracturing, the jellification. If you have a pressurized tank, such as an oxygen tank, if the wall of that tank is compromised, it is weakened, it's going to explode. Same with fire extinguishers, which were inside the building. People may well have heard explosive sound, but were those explosions bombs? I very much doubt it. I would suggest to you that they were things like fire extinguishers or pressurized tanks, turbo toilets, drinks canisters that were in there. Any pressurized canister, once its wall becomes compromised, would explode. Looking at what else happened, if you look in all the pictures, you will see there is almost that you don't see any toilets, any computers, and I mentioned toilets because, or sinks. I mentioned those items because, as Dr. Wood has pointed out, the porcelain is very shiny white substance. You see it amongst the dark and dingy debris. You see it very clearly. You don't see any of that. All that you see is fine dust. And as Dr. Wood pointed out, the dust was fine when it came down, and then it got finer, and it rose up and went into the upper atmosphere, as she has pointed out with some of the satellite pictures. So you've got levitation, metal effects, and then you also have these weird fires. You have pictures of cars in a raging inferno next to paper that's not burning. Guess what? John Hutchison produces cold fires in his experiments. And John Hutchison also produces levitation, and things fly up in the air. Is anybody seeing any sets of coincidences here? Because we sure are.
Yeah, for sure.
And the problem is that this is off the radar screen for people, and it's been, you know, initially it's off the radar screen because of all the Al-Qaeda terrorist nonsense and all this rubbish. But then even for the 9/11 truth, quote-unquote, movement, it is also off the radar because they've been fed bombs and nukes. You know, people can understand what bomb. Everyone knows what a bomb is. Everyone knows what a nuke is. Hardly anyone has heard of the Hutchison effect unless they've looked into the energy cover-up, which I have. And then, you know, you find out Steve Nee Jones, he used to work for Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is, of course, where John Alexander used to work, and John Alexander went to visit John Hutchison. On and on it goes. And then, for example, when Dr. Wood was looking at this plume of material that went up from the World Trade Center, she discovered Hurricane Erin on these photographs, on these satellite pictures. And what was that to do with? Well, guess what? What's associated with a storm? Well, let's see. Would it be an electrostatic field, for example? You know, you get lightning, you get all these electrical effects. Well, John Hutchison uses electrostatic fields in his experiments, doesn't he? So has that got anything to do with it? Now, we don't know for sure, but what I'm showing you and what I'm illustrating here very quickly, and it's obviously much better if you go and look at the pictures and the videos, and Dr. Wood did an excellent presentation in the UK last year where she went through all of this. And if you put Dr. Judy Wood New Horizons, should get up a YouTube video split into two one-hour parts. And you can see all this that I'm going through very quickly, all laid out in a PowerPoint and everything discussed. And so going back to the hurricane, all three New York airports, JFK, LaGuardia and Newark, they reported what is called dry thunder. In other words, they reported the sound of thunder, but there was no, you know, obvious lightning and rain storms there. In other words, the influence of the storm system of Hurricane Erin reached right to New York. So we know that the influence reached there. So we would contend that the electrical phenomena associated with that played some role in the way that the towers were destroyed. Now, we're not sure exactly what that was, but again, we're just lining it up with the characteristics of the Hutchinson effect.
Would this be something to do with sort of rotary torsion fields, do you think?
Well, this is what Richard Hoagland tries to attach to it. Now, he claims to know about these things. Mm. And, you know, that some people give it different names. If you read Dr. Judy Wood's book, what she uses as a term, and it is a mouthful, but it's scientifically more accurate than what Richard Hoagland comes up with. Dr. Judy Wood uses the term magneto-electrogravitic interactions. Now, what that means is that there is some interaction going on between magnetism, electricity, and gravity. In mainstream physics, in the physics that I was taught at university, there is no acknowledged interaction between electricity and gravity, nor is there any acknowledged interaction between magnetism and gravity. There is, of course, interaction between electricity and magnetism. They seem to sort of be interchangeable in many sort of contexts. But there is no disclosed interaction between, you know, gravity is like a separate force. Yeah. Other people talk, like, you know, David Wilcock and Richard Hoagland and to some extent Joseph Farrell have talked about torsion fields, torsion physics. It is possibly one useful term, but they don't come at it from a purely scientific perspective, which is what Dr. Wood comes at it from. Mm. So, you know, we don't really know. What I will say is that the presentation which you witnessed, I think, at Amsterdam last year, had several very important or very serious errors in it, which we weren't happy about. We also thought it quite odd that Richard Hoagland had written a book about the Apollo missions. I found it odd, I should say. I don't know whether Dr. Wood did. He'd written a book called Dark Mission about the Apollo missions.
I've read it. One we cut off with Mike Barra.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, the conference that he went to speak at last year in Amsterdam was called the Secret Space Program.
Yes, we were involved in organising that.
Right, great. Well, yeah, and you know, I think we've spoken about this before, and, yeah, and we know some of the guys that are involved and stuff. And I would have thought that the Dark Mission, to me, I mean, from my own research into that area, the Apollo, if you research into Apollo, it does lead you to the idea that there is a secret space program. And I would have thought that that would be obviously the ideal topic for Hoagland to speak about. But he didn't. I've listened to that presentation. I think he mentioned something briefly about Obama near the beginning.
Let me just tell you, Andrew, I'll be honest with you. We all were quite flabbergasted that we didn't get space stuff from him. And that's what we were there for. To be honest, right, with you, you know, I've shared my points of view about Richard Hoagland and his diva-like tantics. And there were just certain things that we thought were very unnecessary, like fake technical breakdowns of a laser pointer. He then pulls out a NASA-grade laser pointer out of his pocket, which he just happened to have on him. I mean, the other one didn't break down, but the poor technician working on the show felt like such an idiot. But he states the whole thing, you know, he states the whole thing in front of everybody.
Right.
So just certain things that he does, it's very staged. It was a performance, him being up there. And he presented this evidence. And, of course, we saw that clip where you talk about the spire disappearing. Okay. It's very convincing. When you look at that, you go, okay, all right, now there's more to this. Yes, probably disintegrated. And he took us through all of that. And as you say, the Obama stuff, we stood there in front of a photo, it's a photograph of Obama. You always see Obama's back, and you see him looking at a picture of JFK. And Richard Hoagland goes on to say something about Obama will be the next last great president of America, just like JFK was. And I thought to myself, why the hell does he drop this bang in the middle of this presentation? And why this presentation of all things, as you say, at this secret space program conference? It was odd. It was odd. We afterwards, even the organizers, the main organizers, I was just involved in hosting the discussion panel. Mm-hmm. But the main organizers also were like scratching their heads a bit as we just conferred notes.
Right. Well, that's very interesting that you should bring that up. And, you know, And I think I'm glad that you've given us sort of another perspective on that. You know, obviously I wasn't there, but I did hear the audio from that. And I believe they were going to try and post a video of it, weren't they? But then there's some disagreement about that. And that's
it was Richard Hoagland's disagreement.
That was my understanding.
Decided, I mean, they had the agreement to film it and everything. And then the day decided, no. I mean, just like a diva. And it wasn't because he didn't want it out. They just decided to be difficult about something, as he was with everything in that whole period.
Yeah. I mean, we had some similar experience with him when we came to the UK, because I've got a friend in the UK, Anthony Beckett. And, you know, he told me various things along those lines about what happened to Richard Hoagland when he came to Leeds, you know, in 2011. In fact, it was after that Amsterdam conference. It was a few months after that. So, yeah, it's just a pain in the backside, really, and to sort of have to deal with all that nonsense. And you think, well, what's the point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
so trying to get away from it, to be honest with you, you know, when you look at why we do this now, the census is probably the same for you, is that genuinely I'm after truth, and I really am trying to create a better world, because like I'd like to have kids one day, and right now I'm a bit scared, because you know, it looks like a dull and grim place the way things are. But you know, the collective creative imagination can create a better world if we all become aware and focus on good and true and empowering information. And I truly believe that. I believe in the power of the human race. But it's very, very disheartening when you keep getting coming across people who you think are on your side, and actually they turn out to be part of the very agenda you're fighting.
This is what I found, and it does end up being a bit soul destroying. I've almost got used to it now, because I've been, you know, as I say, my experience started in 2007, I suppose, you know, and then I think we spoke before the program about Stephen Greer, for example. I held him up in my own way as some kind of hero, but yet I found there are now some serious questions that he must address, and I've written these up on my website as well. So I suppose, you know, in essence, you do get very disheartened. You do get very you wonder where it's going to end, and are there any good guys left? You know, but you do come across from time to time. You know, and obviously what you're doing to sort of get to the truth is one example of that. And there are others like it that we've come across that have helped us. You know, I've got a list of people in the front of my book, and I was reading that the other day to check something else, and I think, oh yeah, you know, there are still some good guys out there. You know, it sometimes seems like there aren't, but there are some good folks out there helping us, and it's worth reminding yourself of that. But you know, particularly with this information about what really happened on 9/11, I've become I've retained it as one of my main focus of what I'm doing, for several reasons. One is that it does link together, for example, the energy cover up and the war on terror cover up, and it also, now if you look at the Hurricane Erin data, it links in the climate change hoax as well. You know, that factors into it now, as far as I'm concerned, because all this talk of climate change, whether it's man-made, whether it's sunspots, you know, whether it's whatever it is, you have to factor in what happened with Hurricane Erin, because to me that is clear, categorical clear evidence. You know, I'm sure there would be some that would disagree with me, of some type of weather control, and very very accurate weather control going on that day. And that's now, of course, 11 years ago now, very nearly. So that technology is already 11 years old. And so, you know, but my hope is that if we can expose this and make people understand that this sort of technology is real, the free energy technology is real, we can then begin to get a handle on equipping ourselves to deal with it. Now, whether that's going to take place in my lifetime, I really don't know. I tend to not make any predictions for the future, because they often turn out to be wrong. But what, you know, why I'm doing this is to basically try and define the shape of this enemy, or define the armory that it's got at its disposal. And we can talk about things like this energy weapon, and there must be variants of it. We could talk about, for example, the evidence for a secret space program. I'm not saying we're going to do that, but we could go into that as another topic. And we can also talk about, for example, the abilities to do mind control on people, which I'm convinced is going on within the truth movement. And I've even hinted at this in a couple of the articles, and I've pointed out a couple of instances where I've written an article recently about an article I posted about the Vancouver 9/11 conference, And following that, I had some very peculiar emails from somebody that I know quite well. And I've met them, I say quite well. I know them a bit, I should say. I've met them on several occasions. They've known me since 2006. And they're just making some very odd remarks about what I'd written about this conference. It didn't even involve them. And guess who is involved? Jim Fetzer. This Jim Fetzer guy appears to be able to exert influence over people. And I think that's something we've all got to deal with, how people can be influenced, not just by, you know, TV and not just by what they read on the internet, but by some other type of, you know, force, some other sort of system that seems to be at work. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yes, so many. You won't even, you know, it's difficult to know where to begin because there's a long list of disinformationists that we've been able to prove, if not in black and white evidence, then through circumstantial experience, things that didn't make sense or that gave them away. And I think one of the most obvious when it comes down to it is follow the money line. I look at, and I use this as a very good example, and I always big this lady up because she has my hugest of respects, is my dear friend Lisa M. Harrison. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know Lisa M. Harrison, you really should check out some of her interviews. She's probably the best interviewer on the net by far. And she does a far better job than I think people like Kerry Cassidy do. And yet this woman, I mean, she was talking to me last week how she said she was an absolute poverty. She's got three kids. She does this as her hobby, relies on donations. And if there's people I know, you know, within the truth movement like Project Camelot, who, you know, look at Kerry Cassidy, how she travels around with complete ease. And she's not even doing that much great work. She's not a good interviewer and she's frustrating to listen to. But I find that there are certain people with redundant points, redundant focus, or a complete diversionary focus who seem to be having ease of travel, lots of speaking events, going around preaching out a whole bunch of truth, cleverly mixed in with a little bit of disinformation just to keep you confused enough so you don't ask too much more. And as I say, you follow the money line and start looking to the people who appear to have financial ease with what they're doing, okay, and making money out of it, which we don't. You know, 100% categorically, everyone knows that my husband's got his own business, supports me as I do this. But it's definitely one thing for me is that's an indication to look for. And I've spoken to before, as I said, people who are making money, who are very money orientated, are the first people to look at because then they're doing it, number one, for the wrong reason. Because anyone who can – you can appeal to them for money, they can be co-opted. And no one is beyond reproach if they are still materialistically orientated or very centered in the ego or very insecure and needing that kind of gratification and fame.
Right. I think that's all true. You know, and for myself, I've funded all my own activities essentially, I don't live in poverty, but I've kind of chosen a certain sort of way that I've tried to do things, and it appears to have worked out quite well. And I do, you know, I do actually get donations through the website from time to time, and they're essentially, you know, I've had enough donations through my website just to keep it going, and all I've got. You know, I have this DVD order page, and I've literally, you won't find a donate button on my website, but what you will find is if you go onto this order page that I've got, you know, there's like a little, because I got people asking, you know, can I make a donation? I've got quite a few people asking me that over the years. So I put this little box on the order page where people can add a donation, and that seems to have worked quite well. You know, if people just want DVDs, they just put that in, and then if somebody wants to make a donation, they usually sort of put that in, and that's been really great because that means that, you know, I can keep out of trouble with my wife because you know she can't accuse me of spending all money on this because I don't earn my own money from it. And like one guy last year he sent me 500 quid, you know, I couldn't believe it. And I sort of showed this to my wife, and I think she was a bit shocked, you know, that somebody would actually send me this much money. And as it turned out, this was as a result of me going on Richard Hall's program. So, you know, I felt that I must give a good proportion of that to him, you know, through his program, that this guy had come into contact with what we'd done. And Richard doesn't get any money from anybody, you know, and I gave half of it to him, you know. And he told me, for example, that he, when he started off doing this, he was having real trouble, but when he got his program going and he's got a fairly regular audience, he can keep himself going now, you know. And he's got like a 10-year-old car, and and when I went to see him, he was doing his tour, and he'd taken the front seat out of his car to put all these boxes of DVDs in. You know, he didn't like hire a van or anything. He just took his car and stuff, you know. So he's very ingenious, and he works very, very hard at what he does. And he makes that TV program that's on Sky. He didn't get any money for that, you know. They don't pay him. He has to split half of what he earns with the TV channel, or a quarter or something. I forget the exact percentage, you know. So that's how he doesn't, you know, that's how he funds it, just from that, you know. And he only just makes ends meet. But he's very, very resourceful, and that's what you've got to be if you want to fund this honestly. You've got to be very resourceful, I think.
Absolutely.
And, you know, what I try and do is I've tried to give money to other people as well, you know, because I'm making enough from the living that I'm doing. And I try to give money to other people, you know, and I bought some stuff for other people and that when I've had the opportunity, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's tried to keep it within that sort of system, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other things I've noticed with people who... I would say I strike me as controlled opposition is their reluctance to probe beyond a certain level, as you've already spoken about. Like there's, as you say, there's certain blockages within people. They'll talk about one thing, but the minute you tread onto other territory, and I use Alex Jones as a good example because, you know, obviously there's a lot going on with the Vatican. The minute you call up to a show and you start talking about the Vatican, he'll slam down his phone because he himself comes from a Catholic family. His sister attends a Catholic university and his father-in-law is in fact a Knight of Malta, which of course compromises Alex Jones completely in his position.
Yeah, that's it. And also I'd heard that there's this, apparently one of the other things you're not allowed to talk about on his program is the red and blue lists. You know, these lists that have supposedly been drawn up that all the red list people are going to get, you know, slammed into the prisons first. You know, when all the biological waste hits the air circulatory system, as we say. So apparently, you're not allowed to talk about that. And I think, you know, we talked about, I think you talked about the Jesuits as well. And you know, you're not meant to talk about that. And those tend to be pretty much hot topics for certain groups of people. You know, and if those are brought up in conversation, I'm quite happy to discuss them. It's not something I know a lot about. I mean, I've listened to stuff about the Black Pope and, Eric, you know, I know of Eric John Phelps and that. I don't know a lot about it, but there's something going on there, you know, which you need to look at before you pass judgment on it. You know, and that's the point. I will just say I don't know because that's my honest answer. I don't know, you know, because I haven't studied it enough.
When you have a chance, pop onto my website, read my book. I've read a lot about this. I've also got a great interview with Eric. He's Brother Eric.
I'll try and listen to that because I've heard about him, but I haven't listened to it. And I did notice you had that on your site, so I'll have to try and download that and listen to it. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, he is one of the people who I genuinely believe is also exposing disinformationists because he's looking at it from the Catholic perspective. Who is loyal to the Pope? Who has knighthoods? And if you actually study the oaths these knights have to swear, you will understand that they are bound by obligation to do absolutely anything that they are required to do by the Superior General of the Jesuits, which is the Black Pope. You know, anyone who gets a knighthood, that's the case. Yeah, if you don't, then your knighthood gets stripped of you.
Well, I mean, you know, my view on that is there is this, you know, if you look at going back to what we were saying a few minutes ago about how people seem to be, you know, when certain topics are brought up, they react, they're told to react a certain way, like, as you said, Alex Jones. And, I found this, we were speaking about this the other day when we spoke, people reacting to Judy Wood's research. We can see there is some type of hidden network, and I've experienced this with somebody that I counted as a friend. I won't name him on the program, but I know that he was given access to information about my activities, which he couldn't possibly have had. And he then, you know, when I confronted him with that, he wasn't able to answer where he got this information from. So there is this secret network, and I'm wondering if these oaths or whatever it is you know that's going on, blood oaths or something, there's some kind of subconscious network which you know this information is transmitted through, so that they already are briefed in some kind of strange way how to react to certain types of information and how to treat it and how to deal with it, you know. And I A prime example of this is Richard Dolan, in my experience, of just to focus on one particular instance to give people a bit of meat to work with from my end of things. I wrote this article following my meeting with Richard Dolan, and it, again, it centres around exopolitics and UFOs, because I met Richard Dolan in 2009 at the Exopolitics Conference in Leeds, again organised by Anthony Beckett. And Richard Dolan obviously was at that conference, you know, that you mentioned, the Amsterdam one as well, wasn't he?
Yes, also, we've got an interview with them, actually.
Right.
That, yeah.
Well, you might want to read the article I wrote about him, because what happened with him was I met with him and I you know, actually gave him a lift in my car, and we drove to a restaurant and we had a good chat. I bought him some lunch, actually. And I found him it was a good laugh, seemed like an ordinary bloke, you know. He had two children about the same age as my kids, I think a year or two older. We talked about that. I've written all this up in the article. And then I got on to talking. Richard Dolan lives in New York State. He lives in Rochester, New York State. So he's fairly close to the events of 9/11. And I told him about this business where the buildings turn into dust. And I thought it was somehow connected to, you know, black programs, black weaponry. Yeah. And he's written about those sorts of topics in some of his books, from the UFO angle, of course. And I gave him some sheets about Hurricane Erin, you know, and the path of Hurricane. I printed them out deliberately, and I put them in his hand, and some other booklets that I'd made. And so he had all that evidence. And that was in June 2009 that I met with him at this conference. And he sat in on my talk, which was about a chap called Wilbert Smith. And then he went back off to America. And then somebody alerted me to a program that he did, and it wasn't until November 2009 that I heard this program, but it was an anniversary broadcast about 9/11. And I downloaded this 77-minute program that he'd done with his wife, where he's going through about 9/11 and what happened. And I listened to it all, and what does he mention? The only thing he really mentions is thermite. So he mentions this thing called the Copenhagen paper, which was this thing done by Nils Harriot and other people. And he didn't mention one thing about Hurricane Erin and about what I told him about the Hutchinson effect and the energy effects and so on.
He's actually sat through that presentation with Hoagland, actually, in Amsterdam. So I know he knows that information.
Right. That was obviously 2 years. Well, yeah, 2 years later, or almost 2 years later. Right. But if you read this article, you will see why specifically that was very peculiar that he would not mention it. He didn't mention meeting me, you know, not even to dismiss it or to say that he disagreed with it. He did not mention it at all, you know. And I just realized at that point that he was part of the group that was promoting the thermite story. And if you listen to the way that he discusses it, you can see that he's bigging it up and he's making it out to be something that it isn't. And if you listen to him carefully, I think you can see in his voice and the sort of expressions that he was using, he doesn't really believe it either. And it's like he's under some kind of influence, you know, and that's what I hinted at in the article. Now, you know, people that are listening to this might just think, oh, well, that's just Andrew, but it's just his ego or something, you know, and he turned out not to like Richard Dolan or something. Well, all I can say is read the article, you know, look at the links, listen to the original broadcast, because I've saved it on my website, and see what you think. If you come to a different conclusion to what I did, then that's absolutely fine. You know, all I could do is...
One point to put on Richard Dolan about this, and that he was a finalist for a Rhodes Scholarship. You know, that says it all. And if you know anything about the Rhodes Scholarships and how they were set up and the history there, you don't just get considered for a Rhodes Scholarship unless you're coercible. The Rhodes Scholarship is like a secret society.
Ah, right. I wasn't aware of that. So
Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar.
Ah, okay. Well, that makes more sense then. So, you know, this is again point us to these secret networks, and there seem to be, you know, more than one of them. I mean, you've talked about the Knights of Malta and the Catholics, and then of course we've got the Freemasonic networks, and the other one is Opus Dei, isn't it? The family.
Well, they're all connected. They're actually, all those secret societies are ultimately controlled by the Jesuits.
Right. Okay. Well, this is something, again, that I've heard, but I haven't looked into.
Categorically, read my book, Provable. You can trace the line. Yes. Every secret society, be it the Freemasons' headquarters, the Scottish Rite has headquarters right next to the Jesuits in Rome.
Ah, okay.
All report to the senior superior general, which is the Black Pope, who is the superior general of the Jesuits. And he controls basically all the various secret societies going down on behalf of the black nobility, which is
And the other person that we can mention at this point, because what you, you know, mentioning what you just mentioned made me think of it, is that I did have some communication with Leonard Horowitz at
Pop Time.
And you know, I can hear it in your voice, but let me tell you my experience, because again, it relates back to Judy Wood's research. And what happened was, I forget how it happened, but there was somebody on my email list had been communicating with Leonard Horowitz. And for those that don't know, he's supposedly exposed some of the AIDS hoax. That's been done by other people as well, but that was how I first came across him. And I sent him stuff about the towers turning to dust and some postings, because he apparently asked somebody some question or something. And he seemed quite interested in it. And then what happened was, he said in email, "Oh, this looks quite interesting," and he CC'd somebody else, and he said, "Can you check it out for me, Graham or something?" And there was somebody called Graham, I can't remember the guy's name, or Gordon or something, on his list. He was then tasked with checking out this what we talked about, and this guy gets into a whole long email thing with me about set, and he comes out with a thermite story, basically, and he cannot see that it wasn't thermite, and whatever pointers I gave him, he just trots out this thermite story. It's like he's reading it off a script, literally, and typing it into the email or pasting it from a script into his email to send to me. And I'm just thinking, no, you know, where's your brain? Where's your observation gone? You can clearly see that that's not true just by looking at the pictures that are available. And then got this message back from Leonard Horowitz after this exchange, and it said, "Oh, you know, I admire your passion, Andrew, but you know, I can't agree with you on this because of what Gordon said," or something like this, you know. And I'm thinking, why is Leonard Horowitz, you know, discharging his thinking about these particular bits of evidence to somebody else and then agreeing with them? You know,
yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Look, there's people then, like David Icke does the same thing. He does the same thing. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah,
I've come across it. I've seen him do it. So, you know, these big names who come out fronting things, half of them aren't even doing the research for themselves.
That's it. You know,
yeah.
And it's a real shame, you know, and it is very disheartening, quite soul destroying. But obviously, you know, then going back to Leonard Horowitz just a minute, because he's one of these Knights of Malta, isn't he? Or
yep, that's yeah, right.
And I only discovered that after 2 or 3 years. So
it's important you understand their role in things, because once you get the Knights of Malta and you understand who they are and just how they tie into everything, they control everything. They really do.
Yeah. So what is their relationship to the trying to think of the group. It's gone right out of my head, and I've said it so many times, and I can't.
Freemasons.
No, not the Freemasons. The Knights Templar. I can't.
Oh.
So, what's the relationship between the Knights of Malta and Knights Templar, if there is one?
Basically, all papal knights are papal knights. Over the years, they've had many different names. The Knights of Malta had headquarters on Malta, and they later took on that name, but that wasn't their first name. I think the first name they were called were the Knights Hospitalier, and they started the hospitals, which is why hospitals have a red cross, and the knights also have a red cross. Okay. Then they became the Knights of St. John. Now, if you understand what St. John really is, and this gets a bit deeper into Ophia Latreia, which is the worship of the serpent, because you then go into look at what St. John is through the history of, you know, the Catholic Church. And of course, it all goes back to ancient and serpent worship and stuff like that. So they're actually Knights of St. John. And St. John, you can trace back to Oannes. And I do this in my book, who was a serpent god that everybody apparently worshipped back in Babylon. And this is who they, I mean, they're a cult, dark order. Well, you know, I suppose, again, it's a matter of perspective. It's not for me to judge if they're dark or light. What I'm saying is that they practice a very different belief system to what the Catholic Church outwardly get the mass to practice.
It does get very, very complicated and convoluted, doesn't it? Because we're dealing with such a lot of ancient history, which is, you know, lines of it are coming through to modern history.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think some of those lines are sort of slightly broken and crossed over along the way. So, I've known some of the names of the groups and that, but I've not sort of done, obviously, done the research that you've done. So I have to try and read your book.
It's fascinating, you know. And one thing, when you do get the whole Vatican structure, that whole thing, a lot falls into place. So it's important. Speaking of which, you've actually got Kevin Annett out here next week, and we're going to be launching the International Tribunal into Crimes of the Church and State, and basically looking at bringing the Catholic Church to justice for all the crime, for genocide, vaccinations, paedophilia, abuse of children over the years. It's quite a big thing we're involved with, and hopefully we're going to get a lot of support from people because this could be groundbreaking if we get it off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously another whole big area. Right, yeah.
Yes, indeed. But listen, Andrew, we're running to the end of our show, and it's been really wonderful to have you on and such a good chat. And, you know, we'd love to chat to you again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a few more bits and pieces we can cover, and, you know, any time, really. And I do urge people to look at the 9/11 Finding the Truth, and also look at Dr. Judy Wood's website if you want to find out what happened, certainly at the World Trade Center. You know, we don't discuss much of what happened at the Pentagon and so on, but... there appear to have been some similar effects at the Pentagon, which aren't talked about a lot. So, yeah, and the whole issue of planes as well, we haven't really touched on much. So, yeah, and Richard D. Hall's done a very good analysis of the radar data from the World Trade Center as well for the Flight 175 there. So I'd urge people to have a look at that. If I may just give a plug for an event that I've got coming up at the end of the month.
Sure.
Which is going to be in my home. Well, I don't actually live in Derby, but I live just near the city of Derby in the Midlands in England. And I've got an event that I've organised that I booked a place for on the 30th of September, which is a Sunday, running from 11 a.m. till 11 p.m., at 10 p.m. rather. And we've got Neil Sanders coming to speak about mind control and you know, the way that that's used in the media. We've got Richard D. Hall come to speak a bit about this unusual case of the Raoul Moat and how that's linked into some of the mind, seems to be linked into some of the mind control that's being used in some of these sort of cases of gunmen shooting shooting groups of people and so on. Yeah. And he's talking about some of the animal mutilation cases as well that have happened in the UK, which is a quite troubling area as well. And then we've got, I'm going to be speaking a bit about 9/11 and the energy connection, which I talked a bit about here tonight. And we've also then got, at the end of the day, got Lloyd Pye, who's going to be talking about the Starchild skull, which is this 900-year-old real bone skull, which appears to be basically from an alien. And that's a very intriguing piece of physical evidence, and there's been more tests being done on that in the last couple of years, and very recently some newer tests have been done too. And so he's going to be giving us the latest on that. Tickets are £15, so it's going to be, that's going to be for the whole day, and there'll be a cafe there and stuff. So if people want to go onto my website and find it in the events section, you can get tickets for that if you want to come along.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Brilliant. It does seem that conference season seems to be coming up. We have conferences all over the show for people who want to come and get involved and get to know a little bit of what we work with. We just want to talk a little bit about that, a few conferences coming up before we head off as well, since we're talking about yours, Andrew. We've got one coming up on the 17th September. That would be not this coming Tuesday, the Tuesday thereafter. We have Kevin Annett here, who will be here in Holland giving a presentation and, of course, launching, as I said earlier, the International Tribunal into Crimes of the Church and State. Kevin, for those who don't know, is the minister from Canada who has exposed genocide by the church in Canada, and he is over here to take the Vatican to task. And, of course, we will be supporting Kevin in his quest, as well as acting in the capacity of volunteer citizen jurors in this tribunal. Then, of course, there is the Awaken State Conference on the 13th of October 2012 in Edinburgh. Some great speakers, including Thomas Sheridan, who we hope to interview soon, John Wutterick, Scott Tipps, Anthony Peake. And, of course, you can get more details from this on awakenstate.co.uk. And, I think then there's the big one, of course, Andrew, which you'll be joining us at the end of the year, in November, the 9th, 10th, and 11th of November, 2012. Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson will be over here in Holland with a whole bunch of other interesting people. My old friend Michael Tillinger is coming all the way from South Africa, so it's going to be a great group of people, guys. This is a three-day conference. If you've ever wanted to come to Holland or you want to come to one of these conferences, the Breakthrough Energy Movement is the one. It's about solutions. We've looked at all the problems for long long enough and all the conspiracy stuff. It's time to focus on how to make things better. And we've worked with the same people on the Secret Space Program conference and, of course, the famous conference in Brussels where we were attacked. So we know these people well. They're good people and they're putting on a great conference. Many speakers, so make sure you get to this one. It's really going to be great. And if you want any more details, that's GlobalM, GlobalM, GlobalM.com. Or, of course, you can email us and we'll put you in touch with the right people. And you can get in touch with me at info@freedomcentral.info or check out our stuff on our website, which is also freedomcentral.info. And I think we've run out of time for tonight. So, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been great.
Absolutely. And we look forward to having you back. And, of course, we'll see you in November.
Yeah, great stuff.
Brilliant. All right, then. We'll say goodbye to you before I say goodbye to everyone. So take care, Andrew.
Thank you, then. Bye-bye.
Cheers,
now.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.